All right. Well, let's do a thing. Hello and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. I am Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores. We are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you, yes you, somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along its storied way.
Covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles and alternative transportation, arts and culture, communication and the internet. That was really fast. No, maybe I do need this mellow tea here.
So you have a beverage called Marley's Mellow Mood.
Marley's Mellow Mood. Green tea with honey. Decaffeinated relaxation drink.
Actually, I wanted to introduce this to you when we were rolling tape because... Oh. Well, I mean, you know now, but I wanted to capture the reaction and to find out if you actually, like, if there was something
like
about,
as the show goes on, I start.
Oh, either that or just like, fuck that, I'm not drinking a reggae beverage.
Oh, I see. You're going to pull this out, like, before we even hit record.
Or something
or
like
after
that.
After we hit record.
Maybe.
And then
yeah.
You're like, what?
But you were surprisingly amenable to it. Yeah. So this is, there you go. This is actually not an energy beverage. Rather, it is a beverage to make you feel...
Shit.
Oh, it's
sorry.
Okay. It's
you're steam cleaning that
I'm
going to
steam clean
anyways.
This couch, yeah.
Hey, you got a new couch.
I got a new couch. Yeah, my friend Bill, who was our last point on our trip, which I guess I'll describe a little bit later on, he came down and kind of gave me a couch, I guess. There's not too many ways to do that. You put it in a truck.
You got to put it in some vehicle of some kind.
Right, yeah. And I guess the vehicle was necessary. Not necessary, but practical, because he lives north of Battleground, which is like 50 miles from here or something.
Would you say it's practically necessary?
It's practically necessary. It's literally necessary, yes. So anyways, yeah. So Marley's Mellow Mood has...
Yes.
Anointed the new couch for use in my house
now. There you
now.
Go. This couch is relaxing now.
You can see the fabric has already started to spread a little bit.
What I love about this is there is a warning on here. The all-natural botanical ingredients in this product have been specifically blended to mellow your mood and may cause drowsiness. Best enjoyed when you are ready to relax. Do not mix with alcohol. Not intended for children or nursing or pregnant women. Holy shit, what is in this? Persons with medical conditions or those taking prescription medications should consult a physician before consuming this product.
Yeah, I mean, some of that has to be on there legally, but yes, right. It does beg the question, what happens when you drink this? I want to know what happens when you mix it with alcohol. Do you get like soup? You just like fall asleep instantly?
Apparently. I mean... So, yeah, one of the things in here is valerian root, and that's a pretty strong... sedative, like for people who are into what is that field of study called?
Lucid dreaming?
No, with herbs and whatnot.
Pharmaceuticals, pharmacology.
Well, right, but it's
people
more specifically
mixology
for natural
naturopathology.
Sure,
mixology.
Naturopathology.
I don't know.
Herpetology.
Okay.
No, that's the study of lizards.
Oh, I was going to say the study of herpes. It sounds terrible.
It does sound awful.
But, okay.
Anyways, they would often prescribe, or valerian root is an often prescribed sedative for people who are not prescribing things that are synthetically produced.
Oh, okay. So not Valium, valerian.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that... I mean, I think the names are related, but I don't think the two chemicals are related.
Okay, yeah. That seems... We probably need to know more about this before we speak with authority on it.
Is there any chemists in the audience today?
Totally. Well, I just realized I forgot to grab my beer out of the fridge.
Go get your beer.
All right. Do you want to... You start with the entertaining story of you meeting us in North Bonneville and then getting trapped on a freeway.
Oh, yeah. So... I had a late night of riding my bike on the last Pedalpalooza ride, and the last Pedalpalooza ride was probably one of my favorite ones, if not, it can't be my favorite, like, my favorite one will still be the Get Lost ride, but it's pretty close.
I did like the Get Lost ride.
It was really awesome. This was cool in that it was planned, but nobody except the one dude knew where we were going. And it was long. It was well over 10 miles.
Which for a Pedalpalooza ride is long.
That is long, yeah. Yeah, most Pedalpalooza rides are just a few miles.
Here comes a Rise Up Red from Hopworks.
Nice. Is that a tall?
This is a 16-ounce. I don't think that counts as a tall. Maybe it does count as a tall boy.
It's like a 3/4.
Yeah, that's a pint of beer in a can. All right.
All right.
I'll take that. So you were up late.
So I was up late. Yeah, I didn't get home till like 1:30, 2 o'clock. Fell asleep. And then sometime in the afternoon, actually, is when I finally decided to get out of bed and had a message waiting from you and Adele saying, hey, meet us in North Bonneville.
Right.
And this was Sunday, the...
Sunday.
The 31st.
Okay.
31st.
End of the month.
Yeah, yeah. It was the last Sunday in June. And so we did that. I decided, okay, I'm going to jump on my bike and do this.
Yeah, then. It was to see Marlena, which is a band that played at my birthday party last year.
Who kick ass.
Yeah, friend John is the bassist.
Hey, kids, do you like the Melvins? Then you'll love.
Are they like the Melvins?
They often remind me of the Melvins.
I don't know the Melvins very well. Oh. I know they're important to the history of alternative music, but I don't know the Melvins.
They're important to the history of my music.
Okay, yeah. And that's really the important thing for
that's
anybody.
That's all I care about.
How much does it matter? How much does it matter to you?
Right.
Yeah. So you decided to ride out.
So, yeah, I decided, yeah, I'll do this.
On the spur of the moment.
I have nothing going on. I'm off on Monday. I'm off today, Sunday. So I took off.
Yeah.
And plus, I needed a ride. Like, it was too nice out.
You feel cooped up?
I was feeling cooped up, even though, like... It was less than, 8 hours since I was last on my bike, but, well, no, it was more than that. Anyway, regardless, hopped on my bike, did the historic Columbia Highway on the way there.
Which is a nice ride.
Up and over. Yeah. I forget how much I love that highway. When you get up to the Vista House, that's really crowded.
Vista House is a nice view.
But it's a great view.
Hence the name.
It's a really good cool off. Like, you've worked hard to get up that hill, so you're all sweaty and stuff, and it's really cool and windy there.
Yeah, and there's like a 2 or 3 minute downhill to get there after you climb, so you kind of have a bit of a cool off, so you're kind of comfortable when you slide in.
Well, and I'm pretty sure it was like over 90 degrees.
Oh, yeah, it was a hot day.
It was a hot day.
Yeah.
But, coming down from the Vista House, going east is one of my favorite runs
because
it's
so much
fairly
downhill.
Steep and just all these really nice banked curves.
You feel like you're in a Mario Kart game or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or like one of those racing bikes where like you kind of like lean off the bike. You like, and that's kind of what I was doing. Like, you lean the bike to turn, but you're also using your weight the other way to counterbalance.
Totally.
It's so much fun to do that. Passed a few like cyclists on the way, and they like waved. I didn't have my bell then.
Oh, there we go.
But
you could have.
I think that was actually like Pedalpalooza was one of the things that I really wished I had a bell for.
Yeah, yeah. You want to notify people of your presence.
Well, and when you're in a group ride and you see other like cyclists or whatever, or other groups, as in Pedalpalooza, like. Groups would cross each other sometimes.
Yeah. Or people.
Like
of
you
any
ring
kind.
You ring your bell to say hi or acknowledge each other.
Yeah.
And, I always felt like I missed out on like some point of connection for that.
Sure. Because waving is not quite the same as going ding.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or hey.
I've been known to go ding when I can't find the bell.
I do too. And I don't think anyone quite gets that. Like, what's this guy doing?
Exactly.
Ring ring. Whatever, you idiot.
Yeah.
Anyway. So I didn't have my bell. I'm certainly not going to wave while I'm like banking on a turn.
Right. Yeah. You have to maintain control.
Right. I did get bells rung at me. And
there's nothing friendly about wiping out in front of somebody else.
Look what I did for you.
Then you're
just
making,
to say hi.
Making them be friendly to you.
Right.
By getting out there first.
I'm sort of obligating their friendship now.
Bad way to make friends.
Speaking of making friends, so I stopped in, what is that, the Cascade Locks?
Uh-huh.
at Charburger.
Yeah.
That was like, so I stopped a little bit in the Vista House to refill my water bottles and then stopped at Cascade Locks before crossing the Bridge of the Gods.
Home of the Bridge of the Gods.
And before, like, after you do all the turns and everything like that, it's just all flat, you know?
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of routes on the trail. Like, at one point, you know, it turns into just strictly bike and hiker trail. And this is a lot of routes. So you kind of work for that last section.
Totally.
It's really hot. So I stopped in at Charburger just to cool off in the shade there.
Did you eat at Charburger?
I didn't.
No, okay.
No,
it's not worth
anything.
It.
It's not?
No, it's okay. Like the last place that's still doing cafeteria-style dinners.
Wow.
Yeah, where, like, instead of a server,
yeah,
it's not a buffet. You don't get to go back and get what you want, but you say, hey, I would like a hamburger, and they give you a big old tray, and then they put your hamburger on a plate, and you put that on your tray, and then you take it to your table.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
They have a nice view of the river, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's nothing about the experience.
That's kind of their thing. Well, and it's right there, right before the bridge.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. There's another one on Hood River.
You need to stop. Oh, which is right across. No. Hood River's
farther
down.
Out. Yeah, there's a bunch of Charburgers all along the gorge,
oh,
I think.
I didn't know it was a chain.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. It's a small chain.
So I'm outside of Charburger. This is probably one of the most interesting parts of the trip there.
Uh-huh.
As I'm cooling off, I'm drinking water, and this lady comes out of the Charburger. And she's like, whoa, it's hot in there. And, you know, just kind of making conversation, I reply, well, it's hot out here too, you know. and she just, I don't know, like takes it all in and sees that I'm on a bicycle. And she's, oh, my God, I feel so bad now. I shouldn't complain. And I'm like, no, I wasn't trying to make you feel guilty. I'm, you know, just making conversation.
Making conversation.
You know, that's all.
You know, this will be a dynamic conversation immediately.
Right. And she's talking about how, like, her mom is 89 and she shouldn't be out in this heat, but she insisted on going on whatever the paddle boat thing is over there because they do it every month in the summer. And, and she, anytime like someone walked by us, she would point me out and was like, I was complaining it was hot, but he's out here on a bike. And, oh my gosh, I'm such a bad person.
That's hilarious. This is first time I've heard this story.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Oh, I was telling it to Adele then.
Okay.
Because at one point I didn't say this, but in my head I was kind of saying like, lady, stop bringing attention to me.
I'm just a guy.
I just want to drink my water before I go across the bridge.
Makes sense.
And I could even hear her talk. Like, she's walking in, and I'm sure she's talking to, like, her mom or her husband or whoever her dinner party was.
Yeah.
She opens the door to go back into the Charburger, you know, and she's like, hey, there's this guy out here.
I met a guy riding a bike.
I was complaining it was hot. He biked from Portland.
That... And she just wouldn't let it go. So now he's like all the way out. Just like, this guy. There you go. Well, making friends, man.
Right.
Making friends. Right. So you stayed the night in North Bonneville.
Then,
we had a good time.
Yeah, so biked away the rest of the way to North Bonneville.
Should I disclose what time you arrived?
Yeah, sure.
After all the bands played?
After.
Yeah, I felt bad.
Marlena. It was like I got to the turnoff to go to John's house.
Yeah.
Where they were all playing, and I could actually hear you guys.
Yeah, there was
at
new
the
metal
turnoff.
Coming off the porch.
Yeah, and so I didn't even bother to look at the directions. I just started like following the music.
Right.
And I pull up just as like the last notes of the last band are playing.
And I was like, hi, Aaron, here's a bottle of water.
Right. Here's your consolation water.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was all right.
But it was good to see you because that was like Adele and I had started our bike trip like 3 or 4 days earlier, and that was the only
without
point of
telling
connection.
Anyone. You
oh
humps.
Right, yeah. Sorry about that. By the way, we're going on a bike trip.
By the way, we're going to Indian Heaven.
We're gonna be out, yeah, for like a week or two.
Which I loved telling people after I found out where you guys were. I loved telling people anytime they asked, like,
where do they go?
Have you heard from Brock and Adele? Do you know where they're at?
Oh, they're
in Indian Heaven.
Yeah. We're going to miss them. I don't think there's an actually, like, there's no happy hunting ground anywhere nearby there. There is Indian Racetrack,
right.
The terminology of the entire place is well-intentioned and now terribly racist by the way that the turn of yeah. language has become. Yeah. But
I think at one point I said to either you or Adele, like, I think I just call it regular heaven.
Exactly. Everybody goes to the same place. we basically went camping. You met up. And then we went back to the woods after this show, and you went home via the 14.
Yes. Which...
you say via?
I say via. You say via?
I say via. It's probably via.
Well... Yeah, maybe. Is there a linguist in the house?
Seriously.
So the 14 is funny.
It's beautiful in places.
It's really beautiful in places.
Small, narrow, two lanes in places. It's also four lanes and a freeway
and
in others.
And under construction and one lane in some places.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But that was cool because I was the last one across the little divider or whatever. So I had the whole lane to myself for a long time, you know, and...
Got to take your time.
I took my time.
On the road.
And it was mostly downhill, so I didn't really take... I wasn't going to break for it or
right,
anything,
right.
you know, but...
I'm track standing in a construction zone. Exactly.
Certainly there was a big gap between the last car and then myself coming through, and I'm sure people were wondering what the big holdup was as they're waiting for the other flagger to, you know,
right.
flip the flag from stop to slow.
A guy on a bike,
but yeah, and I waved as I went by, and a few cars honked, and I'm pretty sure they were friendly honks.
That's good. That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah. And
Camus is confusing.
So made it to Washougal in like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty good time, and took some time there to in the Safeway and had myself a little bit of lunch. And then Camus is confusing. Camus has good bike lanes though; they're pretty
do.
Wide.
Yeah.
So good for you, Camus. In Camus, there's this, or just outside of Camus, there's this switchover where you're on 14, but you want to get onto the Evergreen Highway.
Right, the old 14.
And at some points, 14 is the Evergreen Highway, but at other points, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And this final point, you know, you want to get off 14 and onto the Evergreen Highway, and that'll get you to the Jackson Bridge.
Glen
Jackson Bridge.
The 205.
Yes.
famous
and
for its bike
instead,
path right in the middle.
Instead, I didn't really decide. It was decided for me by my own ineptitude to pay attention.
It's kind of like fate.
Right. I would stay on the 14 when it's a divided freeway at like 65 miles an hour. And it was fun in a way. In its own way.
but you have to navigate like on ramps and off ramps and traffic speeding past
that
you.
That was kind of exciting, but I certainly wouldn't do that with a group of people.
Right. No pedal-palooza rides. And I don't remember where it begins to be illegal to ride on the freeways in the metro area, but you were close to it.
I was close to it, but apparently it was not.
Okay.
I actually, at one point, was kind of praying to myself, please, no cops. I really don't want to have to justify how I got onto the freeway.
Yeah.
And the worst part was, you know, at some point the 14 goes under the 205.
Yes. And that's a terrible interchange. I can't imagine riding that on a bike. That seems like the worst.
It's a separate cloverleaf. Like the cloverleaf comes onto like another two lanes that are separate from the actual 14.
Okay.
So it's a mess of cars, and I just kind of had to navigate through them. And at one point, I had to make this sort of split second decision of like, do I stop and lose all my momentum? And I've been pedaling pretty hard this whole time.
Sure. For your life.
Pretty much. 'Cause you can't really go slow and then have a car or big truck pass you and all that wind hit you in the back. It like really can jar your sense of balance.
Yeah, so you need momentum to stay upright.
Yeah, exactly. so I didn't really want to like break and like lose all my momentum. But in the meantime, on an on-ramp, cars are accelerating towards you.
Yeah.
As opposed to I could manage the off-ramps and getting across those because most cars are already, they've got their foot on the brake, the people
right.
driving the cars.
They're preparing to stop.
They're preparing to slow down and possibly stop once they get off the freeway. I didn't have as much trouble getting across those. But yeah, so people are accelerating, and it's a lot harder to judge distance as something is accelerating towards you. And I just, at some point, I just jerked my wheel and cut across as fast as possible because there was just enough of a gap that
just either, make the call and yep, commit.
Either I do it or I have to stop, and then I'll probably be here forever.
Right.
Until a cop comes. But the funny thing about this, so I navigated all of that 205 Cloverleaf at one point, deciding not to, but debating in my head, well, maybe I should just get on the 205.
Which you I will know. Say now is a bad idea.
Right.
Don't try
right.
that.
In retrospect, I realize this would have been a poor decision.
Right. Kids, don't ride on the freeway.
Don't ride on the freeway. Yes. Adults, don't ride on the freeway either. Anyways, the cool thing, though, was right after that whole mess, there's another overpass that doesn't have an exit or an entrance, except there is a marked bike path right there that gets you
from
off the freeway.
From the freeway.
Off the 14.
To Ellsworth Avenue.
To Ellsworth, yeah. Which gets you back onto the 205.
Kind of like a punchline at the end of all this, just like...
Oh, it totally was. I stopped for a while, you know, to kind of get my bearings and drink some water again, and I was laughing. I was just laughing hysterically. I couldn't... I really almost couldn't control myself.
The humor of the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like... I probably could have been dead 5 or 6 times over already.
I'm glad you're not.
Me too.
Welcome,
me too.
Welcome back.
I'm also glad I am not dead.
Well, cool, man. Well, hey, we've got...
That was a long-ass story.
No worries. We've got an interview that we taped earlier with Tom Allen, the subject and creator of the film Janipar and the author of the book of the same title. So we'll roll that now, and then we'll be back on the other side to talk about mail and news.
And joys.
Yeah.
Sure, just go for it. I mean, I'll just talk. And if it
exactly.
makes sense, it makes sense. And if it doesn't, it doesn't.
Perfect.
Any subject we should steer clear of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Sounds good.
Maybe international politics. Let's not go there. <All right. laughs>
Sounds good. Well, welcome back to Portland, Tom Allen. Thank you for joining us at the Sprocket Podcast Studios, the illustrious studios, which still is kind of an empty apartment. So,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, you have been. You said you were at the World Domination Summit this weekend.
Yeah, that's right. I was showing my documentary at the conference. Which isn't quite as malevolent as it sounds, as I'm sure most locals will know.
You know, world domination, it's okay as long as it's benevolent.
As long as it's peaceful, yes, it's fine.
Yeah, and this is, I've heard people talking about it, but what's the what's kind of the major thrust of this conference?
So it's basically a get-together for people who want to kind of live a little bit outside of the box and kind of change the system. On their own terms and kind of live on their own terms, and whether that's entrepreneurship or adventure or kind of creativity, all these kinds of things which are kind of self-motivated as opposed to kind of working for large institutions and corporations and that kind of thing. So it covers a broad spectrum, really, and there were attendees from all over the world. I think there were 33 countries represented.
That's pretty good.
They had 2,800 people coming into Portland for the weekend, and they hired out, you know, some of the big venues in the center of the town, and a series of lectures and workshops and kind of meetups to kind of, you know, inspire each other and get some ideas flowing and look into this kind of alternative way of living a little bit more.
We actually have one of our listeners, Tim, is he's from Washington D.C., but he was also in for the conference, and I think we're going to be.
That was the guy that organized the float, or
what?
That
was he at least sent me an email about it. Okay. Yeah, Did you hear about the world?
Were you part of the float?
I wasn't part of it. Okay. I wanted to be, but they'd sold out of inner tubes.
Oh, really?
So I couldn't.
I guess that's a good thing.
But apparently they broke a new world record for the longest floating human chain.
There we go.
So good for them.
Good, yeah, because that was when Tim had sent me the email about it. I was hoping I'd be able to go, and then we ended up being out in the woods camping, and so I wasn't able to go, and the email was something about, like, you know, we're not sure if we're going to get enough people to do it to actually break the record. And so it's good to know that that actually happened. So mm-hmm. It was the longest float chain, like people in inner tubes on the river.
Yeah, all holding hands at the same time. I think it was just over 600 people they got floating on the water all at the same time.
That's not bad.
Holding hands, so.
Yeah, I'm curious about the first person to set that record and how they kind of how they got the idea, like, oh, hey, if we all link up and, you know, we're probably the most people that's ever done this or something like that. But
sure.
Imagination. So indeed. You were here to show your film, Janipar. Mm-hmm. And last time we spoke to you, it was still in production. So you you were on tour with your brother down the West Coast. Yeah. And by now the film has released. You had the premiere and it's been showing at other places around festivals and whatnot. And it's available on DVD. Is it janipar.com?
Janipar.com.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And we'll have a link up to that on the website. But also the accompanying, is it novel, book, memoir?
It's kind of it's a memoir, of course. It's a true story. It's part travelogue, part memoir, part kind of coming-of-age tale. It's a kind of a mixture. Mm-hmm. Personal story, but one that's kind of got relevance to it. Like, you know, a lot of people who've been through this kind of stage of life, of kind of questioning what they take for granted and kind of wanting to explore a bit further.
Yeah. Well, let me congratulate you on the writing of the book. And I remember you were posting as you were doing it was kind of one of those hair tearing sorts of experiences where it was both good and you were working hard and it was frustrating to try and get it as precise as you were hoping to, just the wordsmithing and putting sentences together and saying what needed to be said. But it's an amazing work of writing, and I would say probably of all of the bicycle books that I've read about bicycle touring, it's the best. So congratulations, and thank you for putting it out there.
Thank you. Yes, you're right. It was a real struggle. It was kind of a bit like a very long wrestling match in which you're not quite sure what victory is going to look like mm-hmm. until you get there.
And you kind of locked yourself away, right? Like you just took time to could be alone and you and the words and figure out how they went together. And
that's right. I started out by basically, to put things into context, I'd been on the road out of my own country for 3.5 years at the point at which I decided to start telling the story and writing this book. And so the first thing that I did was I headed off to the Arctic Circle in the middle of winter on my bicycle to kind of get some headspace.
They have headspace up there, right?
They
here.
Do. Yeah. They have a hell of a lot of headspace. So I was riding on my own through the kind of snowy wilderness for about a month, just kind of collecting my thoughts on what kind of shape it might take, and returned from that trip and started writing. And it took me about 3 months, I think, to get a first draft done. I sent it off to some close friends, some trusted people for feedback. They didn't give me any feedback because none of them got past the first couple of chapters. So I deleted the whole thing and started again. And this is a kind of iterative process which carried on for about 2 years before it finally kind of took the shape, which I felt worked and did it justice.
Okay, yeah. That's I've done a little bit of writing, and I think probably kind of like your first draft, it's not the sort of thing that most people probably want to slog through for chapters and chapters of, so it's probably nice to have an editorial team, I assume. And
sure.
How long was the process? Like, how long from start to finish do you think before the book was done?
Well, like I said, I started 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
from now.
Yeah.
And the book came out in January. So okay. 2 years from putting the first words down to having the finished copy in my hands.
There we go.
2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was amazing. The film that you produced, you and, was it James Newton is the producer?
That's right. James Newton, a good friend of mine, produced and directed the documentary.
Yeah. I thought the backstory was interesting in that you started the film project was originally meant to be kind of a web series.
Sure. It was kind of like a video podcast.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
That didn't go very far. I think we got to episode 5
uh-huh.
and realized that nobody was really interested in
okay.
this story of middle-class white blokes on bikes in Europe.
Right. Was it was that disappointing, or was it just kind of like looking for a new outlet for the media that you'd shot?
It was disappointing in that, you know, we'd put a lot of effort into shooting, mm-hmm. and we felt that we'd come on quite a long way from being total novice filmmakers. But I guess it also brought us back down to earth and showed us that we still had a very, very long way to go mm-hmm. With our filmmaking skills. And so in that way, it was kind of inspiration to make a bit, do a better job going forward. And so, you know, you get to the later months and years of the footage, and as a result of kind of studying documentary and camera work and all that kind of thing, whenever I had the opportunity, it kind of, the footage starts to get better. It starts to become usable.
Right, right. You learn what to shoot and what not to. And,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Sure. There's so many things to think about when you're shooting, mm-hmm. And being obviously in the situation yourself and actually having the traveling experience at the same time. It's a lot of stuff to think about.
Right. Right. Did you ever find yourself kind of like in the meta position of like not being able to appreciate your surroundings because you were thinking about the production of the story or the film?
It had the opportunity, it had the potential to have that effect.
Okay.
And I tried to isolate that by confining the periods of time in which I'd be actually shooting. So I'd have my camera equipment all available and ready to go for, let's say, a week, and I would shoot, you know, stories that I found along the road that I felt were relevant or interesting and had potential. And then I'd put the camera away for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks maybe, and I'd shoot absolutely nothing apart from occasional video diaries when I was camping at night.
There we go.
Just to kind of keep a record for what happened.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I did that deliberately to stop it overtaking the experience, because it's very, very easy for a documentary shoot to become just a production and actually not the journey that it was supposed to be originally.
Right.
Or not the experience it was supposed to be, because the camera takes over.
Right. So the discipline kind of, like, you find a way to kind of parcel your time out so that you're not always on, basically.
Sure. And that, you know, that took time, but I had a lot of time. 3.5 years is plenty to kind of find a balance.
And pretty much all self-determined, right?
Self-determined.
As far as, like, you kind of called your schedule and where you were going and what your days looked like.
Sure. I mean, I think with bicycle touring, the whole point is you can go as fast or as slow as you like. You can go in whatever direction you like. But you do have to keep going, because that's what, you know, the kind of the changing environment is what keeps it a journey, as opposed to you just stop and bum around for a while, which I did occasionally do as well, because you do need some breaks.
Yeah.
But yes, it was totally kind of free and, you know, flexible in terms of itinerary.
Yeah. Cities are good for kind of the bumming around. It's sure. hard to bum around in the wilderness and, sure. and kind of enjoy it, I guess.
Yeah. Unless you've got company.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if you have people with you, then you can do it for longer. But then eventually you need to, like, get soap and food and things like that.
Sure.
And some of them you can harvest from the wild. Some mm-hmm. you cannot, I guess.
Yeah, like the soap.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not really natural soap. It's hard to find.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was, we were just talking before you arrived, Tom, about just kind of going out and wayfinding. Aaron, you were saying that wayfinding is
That's probably, yeah, that's probably my least developed skill.
Yeah. Would you find, Tom, that you have, do you have a natural sense of direction in your head, or is it, do you need compasses and maps and that sort of thing?
Well, I'd say that at the very beginning, I had no real navigational skills at all. And that's just because in, you know, the modern life, we don't really use them. Mm-hmm. We don't kind of look at the sky to work out which direction we're going. We don't kind of track the progress of the sun over the course of a day to kind of calculate which is east and which is west and what time it is. You know, we don't kind of look up at the sky to check what the weather's going to do. We don't read landscapes. We don't really think about urban design very much and about how cities evolve and stuff like that, because we have, you know, quite small, they're quite small worlds we live in generally. We don't, you know, if you're stationary in your life, you don't often go that far out of the place you already know. And when you do, inevitably we have now smartphones, GPSs, all this kind of thing. So I guess, you know, I think everyone's got that ability in their head. It's just, it requires reactivation or kind of training to get back into it. And, you know, as a result of being on the road all day, every day, you automatically just learn basic stuff like that, and your brain kind of re-engages with its surroundings, and you just become better at getting around. And so while we use maps to get through quite a bit of Western Europe, just because of the sheer amount of route options.
So many choices. Yeah.
Once I left Western Europe and things got a lot, I guess there were less options for which route I might take.
Right. Right.
So taking Egypt, for example, you want to go from Egypt to Sudan, from starting in Cairo, you go south, you follow the Nile.
There's a road for that.
There's a road on both sides of the Nile. You choose whichever one looks prettiest and just follow the river.
Yeah.
So I never had a map of Egypt.
Yeah.
And I spent a month cycling through Egypt.
That would freak me out. Yeah, you're talking about looking at the sky and getting your orientation that way. That seems like advanced to me.
The thing is,
it's a challenge just to even read the map right, you know. Am I holding this up correctly? Am I orienting myself to the map correctly?
I used to play games, actually, with myself to kind of keep myself entertained. I used to have this game where I'd look at the sun and try and guess as closely as possible to what time it was based on how far across the sky it had come, how close to the horizon it was, how long the shadows were. And I got pretty good. I could usually get within about half an hour of the correct time.
Nice.
I guess
if you have like all this time on a bike,
you
make up these things to kind of occupy your mind.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you were saying it's kind of like you start to learn some of the natural patterns and you figure out some of the way that the natural world works just by osmosis, like it kind of seeps into you as you spend time in it.
Sure.
So, yeah.
And also the way that the human world works and the way that people think about, building man-made mm-hmm. world. You know, if you look at a landscape, it's usually quite obvious where somebody would put a road through that landscape. And,
right.
You know, you can kind of guess what kind of route you're going to be taking through a valley, where you might go over a pass, that kind of thing, just by looking and thinking, thinking like a road builder, how would I get my road from here to the other end of this valley and over the top? And
so you could kind of guess where the path was or where the pass was just looking at the horizon and seeing.
Sure, I mean, you could just kind of, yeah.
Huh.
I mean, it wasn't, I'm not saying that I could magically find my way all the time every day without getting lost, but I did get lost quite often, but that wasn't really a problem because it usually meant I ended up somewhere I didn't expect and something unexpected and interesting happened.
Huh. Right. And that's kind of part of the reason that you were out, was just to see something that you hadn't seen before, I suppose.
Sure.
As many of us are.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I figured, you know, it doesn't really matter where I am. If it's somewhere new, it's somewhere new.
Mm-hmm.
Like the idea of having to get to a specific place at a specific time wasn't really relevant. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think last time you were in town when we were talking together, I had asked you something about like your itinerary and you had talked about kind of throwing out the entire itinerary that you'd set up and just saying, let's see where the wind blows basically.
Sure.
And where I'll end up from day to day. And it was really inspiring. I think I probably told you before, I am a kind of a planner by nature, and you know, I like ironing out timetables and itineraries and figuring out like what's possible and where we can stay and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And I think after talking to you, I kind of abandoned the planning thing for our tour that summer. And it worked out. It worked out really nicely because, like you were saying, like it kind of gives you opportunities that you would not find if you weren't open to the opportunity. You wouldn't be able to camp in a beautiful place, for example, because you'd have to press on, or you wouldn't have gotten there. So thank you. It's kind of a nice lesson to learn. And
pleasure.
I'm sure it depends on people's temperaments, but like,
of course, and I think it's a learning process.
Because yeah.
The kind of uncertainty and unknown is. It's a fear we have, and I think we all have. Mm-hmm. And so it's natural to want to plan because it eliminates a certain amount of the unknowns. The things which we think are going to cause problems if we don't already know what's going to happen.
Right.
And I mean, before I left, I was a planner. I spent a year planning my journey.
Uh-huh.
Like we talked about before, I threw that itinerary out once I'd actually come to terms with the reality of being on the road, which is that flexibility is way more valuable than structure, I suppose, in that environment when you're kind of exploring and you want to express curiosity about things. So, you know, it took a year of planning for me to build up the confidence to then leave and throw all the plans out the window. So I'm not completely dismissing planning outright. I think it's really useful in getting to a starting to the starting line.
Right. Right. Yeah. And you have to be there. You have to know how you're going to get out, for example.
Sure.
But yeah, especially in the wilderness, one of the first times that my wife and I on our tour last year tried wild camping was because of, you know, because of your influence, I think, and saying, hey, let's try this and just camp somewhere. And she was, I think, excited about the idea far earlier than I was. And I'm not sure, Aaron, if you remember in conversation what we were talking about at that point, like if we talked about camping and campgrounds versus camping in the woods, like wherever you land.
I remember this coming up actually just last weekend.
Okay, yeah, because that's kind of how we did our last trip. Yeah, this past 10 days.
If I recall Adele correctly, it was almost all what I used to call bandit camping or wild camping.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it's, I don't know, I find that I enjoy that a lot more now. Like, you need to shower every now and again, but most of the campgrounds that we were going through on our trip this last week didn't have showers, even sometimes not even running water. So either you pay $18 to camp on dirt, or you camp on dirt for free, and there's not too many differences. And in fact, many of the places that we stayed were probably superior just in quality and setting and solitude to actually paying for camping. So yeah, it's kind of nice to break out of that box, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any particular spots that kind of stay in your mind? I know you've stayed in so many places that it might be hard to choose one as a favorite, but like, are there places that you kind of think back to like, that was a good campsite?
Oh yeah. There was one which kind of blows everything else away. It was in Northern Mongolia. And me and my friend Andy had been mountain biking across Mongolia for about a month at this point. Mongolia doesn't really have any roads, doesn't have any paved roads at all. Mm-hmm. No, there's no sealed roads. So navigation is basically follow the tire tracks across the valley and hope for the best. but we got to this kind of very northern part of Mongolia, which is more kind of Siberian in landscape, so not really kind of steppe or desert, but kind of semi-alpine, you know, temperate forest, boreal forest, and it was a kind of a nature reserve, an extremely large one,
okay,
with a very, very big freshwater lake called Lake Hovsgol, about 70 miles long, and it was May, it was still kind of, it was mostly still frozen over, but there was kind of 10 or 20 meters of clear water around the edge where it had been thawing out. No one around, no one living there because of the fact it was a nature reserve. We'd been following a single track for the entire day up the bank. We had no real clue where we were going to come out. Well, we kind of had an idea of where we wanted to come out and that hopefully there would be a town there, but we didn't know. So it was kind of a real wilderness kind of adventure. We were struggling to get our bikes through this single track, through this kind of forested lakeside.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually we came to a kind of clearing about halfway up the lake, which was just, you know, the most perfect, most idyllic kind of campground overlooking this 70-mile long semi-frozen lake and mountains on the far side and forest behind and complete and utter silence. I spent about half an hour getting this panoramic photo of it.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, the memory of that place is, it was so nice. We just stayed there for 2 days. We just set up camp and lit a big fire and went swimming in this ice cold water. And,
yeah.
I mean, just the most stunning, untouched, pristine wilderness I think I've ever seen.
That is great.
In Mongolia, which is not really exactly where you'd expect to find that kind of thing.
Definitely. Quiet is hard to find. That's something I was thinking about. And I mean, even as remote as my trip was last week, I don't think we ever got to places where you could still hear airplanes going over from time to time and there'd be traffic or whatever because we were never that far from roads. But quiet is difficult to find. So just being able to find that and kind of be content with that is that's a find in itself.
Absolutely.
But then add the Mongolian lake and that sounds lovely.
Especially after a month of slogging across the dirt.
Right.
It was a real treat.
Was this your first encounter with water for a while, or at least a large water feature?
We'd followed a couple of rivers. We'd crossed a couple of rivers. It was the first decent-sized lake we'd come to.
Okay.
But we'd heard really good stuff about it. We'd heard that you can just drink the water straight out of the lake, no treatment. It's crystal clear and, you know, totally untouched and unspoiled. And it was all of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, really, really memorable.
That's lovely. Have you ever had any encounters with waterborne illness, that sort of thing? I remember there was part of the film has you sick. That was it malaria? Yeah.
Yes, malaria. I mean, I guess that was from mosquito bites.
Okay. Yeah.
Waterborne illnesses. I guess I got a couple of bouts of diarrhea from probably, you know, a bit dodgy water that I got in Sudan. There was a couple of road working camps that I stayed in, and they had like one of these big bowsers full of water that some tow truck had dropped off,
right,
which had been sitting in the sun for a month and
just breeding all sorts of bacteria.
Yeah, exactly. Goodness knows what. But I was pretty lucky in general. I didn't really get that ill.
Yeah, yeah. And I would imagine there's probably something about being exposed to the natural world and just being out in, being outdoors for a while that probably kind of it makes you somewhat resilient against some of that stuff. Like you might become hardier over time.
I think so. I think just the quantity of exercise you get on a bike tour, you know, 5 or 6 hours of riding a day every day for months. It probably does something to your immune system. I'm not a doctor, I don't know, but I imagine it'll help somehow.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that was most intriguing, I think, and something that was really, I don't know if poignant is the right word or not, but I was sharing this with you, Aaron, was you have the introduction, I'm Tom Allen, and I throw rocks at children.
Oh, yes.
it was just the way
Let's
that you...
talk about throwing rocks at
That was
children
one of those things we weren't going to talk about, guys.
There it is. We found it.
It was just fascinating. The moral quandary that kind of you explore through the narrative that you wrote down was fascinating.
Lest people stop switching off their podcasts right now, I should probably explain. this was something I wrote in my book about my experience in Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is quite infamous amongst bicycle adventurers in that there's quite a lot of... You have quite a lot of encounters with large mobs of kids because the kids generally, they go to school in the morning and in the afternoon they're put on sheep or goat duty. Ethiopia's population is massively rural and very, very kind of, what's the word? I guess very well dispersed in the countryside. So you're very rarely out of contact with people, especially kids. And they discipline the sheep and the goats, or at least get them where they want them to go, by chucking rocks at them. And they don't see that many white guys on bicycles, but when they do, it's like perfect. It's a moving target. Let's take a few pot shots
and see what happens.
And
yeah.
Sometimes they can kind of get, you know, how kids kind of get the kind of crowd mentality. They kind of get a little bit out of control and just overexcited,
kind of outdoing their friends.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when you've got 200 of them all trying to lob rocks further than their mates at you, it's quite intimidating.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You're kind of under a barrage of missiles. Yeah. Thrown at you,
and when you're cycling up gravel roads uphill at 3 miles an hour,
slow going,
there's nothing you can do about it. It's even worse.
Yeah.
But so I kind of had to make peace with that in my mind. I had to kind of get my head around the fact that it was nothing personal. It wasn't. It was no reflection of me as an individual. I just happened to be a white guy on a bicycle.
Right.
You know, it would have happened to any other white guy on a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't really kind of, you know, I couldn't blame them personally. I couldn't really perceive it as an act of aggression against me as an individual because it wasn't.
Right.
And that was very tough to get my head around. But once I'd done that and once I realized that it was nothing personal, I figured, well, my response is also going to be nothing personal.
Right.
So I need to just find a way of dealing with this before I get, you know, rock hits
me
in
the head
and I get...
Something, yeah.
You know, concussed or knocked out or whatever. And I discovered during one particular incident that a really, really good way of stopping these kids from chasing me and lobbing rocks was to slam the brakes on, leap off the bike, and then reach down for a rock from the road. And they would, you know... and the thing is, I saw adults in Ethiopian villages doing this to kids to discipline them. If the kids were getting rowdy, one of the adults would kind of just lean, you know, bend down and pick up a rock, and the kids would all just bolt.
Right.
And scarper.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to employ this technique in order to stop this, you know, this daily stoning basically from happening.
You show them you mean business, basically.
But, you know, sometimes the kids are still quite cocky and they won't take a hint. And Seth thought, well, I'm just going to lob it. I'm not going to try and hit them. I'm just going to chuck the stone so they know that I'm serious.
You have to make good on your promise, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I started doing that when particularly stubborn kids wouldn't stop despite my best efforts. And it was only afterwards when I put some perspective around this and I thought, hold on, this is kind of goes against every instinct towards diplomacy that I've ever learned.
Right.
And I've actually turned into somebody who throws rocks at small children.
Because you've been raised to be like a nice person, basically, and you are. At some point you find the need to either pantomime the picking up the rock or actually lobbing the rock back and saying, hey, this is just communication in the context we are in.
Exactly.
Well, you can pantomime all you want. Eventually someone's going to call your bluff.
Yeah. Right. I mean, but that's exactly what you just said is exactly right. It was the context I was in. And outside of that context, I just sound like a complete, I don't know what. Like
exactly.
Child stoning bastard.
Right. But here in Portland, for example, you haven't been throwing rocks at people.
No, I haven't thrown rocks at kids for a while.
It doesn't work in the same way here, yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, some people may kind of take offense kind of on a fundamental level. So.
Yeah.
But I've explained it to the best of my ability, and I can say with absolute certainty that anyone in that situation would have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was the only thing that worked.
Totally. Well, that's one of the things that I appreciate about travel is that when you put yourself in strikingly different situations, you start learning a lot about yourself and a lot about how the world works. There was another, I think, account in your book where you were talking about the nature of religion and belief and... you yourself don't claim religion at this point in your life.
No.
And there's basically you were saying like, I don't get it, but I can see how other people either need this or want this or why it makes sense for them. And I think those are examples of why travel is so great. I think people who travel probably have a better perspective on the world at large just because it's less anecdotal and more based on experience. So
Absolutely.
You don't make generalizations about people. You can say, oh, I've met people from this part of the world and this is what they're like.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, I think that's a really great way to kind of round out your perspective on the world.
Absolutely. And I think with long-term travel in particular, your experiences start to kind of accumulate and you start to see patterns.
Mm-hmm.
You can understand from that there are common themes running throughout all of human life in no matter what particular culture or way of living. It's there are a lot of commonalities, way more in fact than what differences we can see between each other.
So you're bitten by the travel bug, obviously. This is something you like and something that that you're into. Right now, you're kind of traveling with the film and taking it from place to place. What do you see coming up after the film junkets are done?
I'm not sure. I'm trying not to kind of construct a big plan for later on. I'd like to see what kind of happens kind of organically off the back of what I'm doing right now, which, like, as you said, is kind of quite a lot of traveling with the story to kind of share it, which is a lot of fun in itself. And I can see that will probably continue for a while. I'm not sure how long, but at some point it will probably run its course for me personally. I will want to kind of move on from retelling a story which will be increasingly in my past and look forward. But what that might be, I'm not sure. I imagine it will have to do with travel, and I think it will have to do with kind of being of more service to others and kind of helping, enabling, facilitating other people with their ideas for travel.
Yeah, that's good, actually. It's reminds me of our friends with the Pathless Pedal. They have a kind of a very similar thing where they've started telling their own story and now they're working in like tourism advocacy and getting people out on bikes. And yeah, that seems good. And also, I mean, even as I asked the question, I was thinking it's kind of like, well, based on like not wanting to make plans too far in advance, you do want to kind of save some of that mystery for later. So
sure, yeah. Absolutely. I'm guilty of being way too spontaneous for the modern world, not planning well enough in advance for anything in particular, and so there is a balance to be had, of course.
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe just in closing, Aaron and I are now both on a system where we use Google Voice and what I guess you use Google's built-in phone call service. I use Skype.
Yeah.
But we're both essentially on Wi-Fi
phones.
Well,
I have to use a third-party program to access that. But yeah, basically a Wi-Fi phone, though.
Yeah. You've been without a phone, I believe, since you've been in Portland. What do you notice about the experience?
The experience of not having a phone?
Yes.
It's quite impractical. I really wish I had one. You know, it depends. If you're traveling long-term and you're mostly rural, it's not really a big deal. If you're in a city for 4 days and you've got a lot of things you need to do and a lot of people you need to meet, then a phone is bloody useful. Let's face it.
Logistics, yeah.
I just never got around to getting a SIM card. Anyway.
No worries. No, it's...
I'm here. I made it.
Yeah. Now I go back and forth on it because on my last trip, the last place I was going to stay was with a friend, and I thought I remembered how to get to his house. But I also found once we got in his neighborhood that I couldn't find the house. He wasn't home. And... basically, I was standing there in the dark waiting to find the place. And without a Wi-Fi
signal to access.
Yeah, and Adele had a cell phone that she brought, but we did not have my friend's phone number. So it was all these little logistical pieces that were kind of sliding around, never quite connecting. Eventually, we called a friend, got the phone number, and made it work. But yeah, it was interesting. I was thinking at that point, like, you know, maybe I should rethink my commitment to simplicity in telephones. Maybe I should just get a cellular signal.
But I always just go back to, you know, we survived for eons without this. We can figure this out.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
It's a compromise. I have an extremely basic Nokia,
yeah,
which makes calls and sends SMSs, and that's it.
Right. And that's
no Wi-Fi, no Macs.
Sure. Yeah. It's good to be connected, yeah. And you find out, I guess, when we put ourselves into these situations, we find out where those limits are and when we need them. So.
Sure, I think it just depends, doesn't it? It depends on the context.
Yeah,
like so many things. I was in Iran earlier this year, and I did buy a very cheap smartphone, a kind of old secondhand one on eBay, just to see if it, you know, added to my experience whilst I was on the road. And, you know, I got Instagram and I started posting photos of where I was. And I used this kind of flashcard application for learning vocabulary for Farsi.
Which That's is right,
the,
yeah.
The language I was learning, I went there to learn, basically. And then it broke. I was trekking through the mountains and it just failed to switch on one day. And that was the end of that. And as soon as it broke, my experience transformed massively for the better. Because... I've been focusing on kind of training myself to learn vocabulary all the time for this language learning project I was working on, kind of capturing images rather than actually looking at what I was, where I was.
Sure. Very thick glasses, basically.
Exactly. And and constantly updating people. And yeah, as soon as that all dropped away, I suddenly realized that I could focus on what I was actually meant to be there for, which was... communicating and observing the here and now of my trip. And I didn't miss it one bit, and I've never replaced it.
yeah, I can appreciate that. I'm a smartphone guy, but again, without the phone, so I guess I've gone the other direction. But there's something about the whole package of having like all the images and the connections and the cell phone stuff, like it's so distracting that it really does kind of pull you away from what's happening in the world around you.
Well, there's been several experiences I've had with hanging out with friends where I look around us and, you know, there's four of us in a room and we're all staring at our rectangles,
mm-hmm.
You know, and there's four or five of us in a room. We could be hanging out, we could be talking, we could be connecting, and somehow like hanging out has turned in and connecting has turned into like we gather together and we're within each other's presence, but we're not exactly engaging here.
And there's this kind of culture of validating the fact that you met in real life by sending a tweet or a Facebook message to someone to say, nice to meet you today. As if in the virtual world, like saying that in the virtual world validates the real experience.
Right,
which I think is a funny kind of paradigm.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever happened to the American Bandstand? You know, whatever happened to going to the park with a picnic? Well, Tom, thank you for coming in. It's good to talk a little bit more. And you're showing, by the time this releases, of course, it'll already be over, but you're showing a film, your film, tonight at VeloCult, so mm-hmm. we'll be out for that. And it's thomasbiketrip.com.
thomasbiketrip.com, yeah.
Giannapar.com for the film.
Sure.
And the book. And anything else?
No, I mean, that's all. I mean, my blog's about not only my own stories, but also about, you know, breaking down the boundaries, or breaking down the barriers between and having an idea to do a bike trip and actually beginning one. So anyone interested in bicycle touring, there's loads and loads of resources there. I've put everything that I know about it out through that blog. So
it's a great resource.
All right.
All right. Cool. Great. Well, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, every time I take them off, I like kind of unconsciously squeeze them, and of course, it, you know, makes smaller.
Yeah,
and it apparently is much easier to condense these headphones than it is to expand them.
I can't expand them on my head. I've tried.
I don't think they're made to do that.
Well, hey, we've got some mail.
We've got mail. I'm not going to sing it this time.
No, I'm going to drop in the sounder of you.
Okay, only
singing the song.
Only if you also include you telling me to shut up right afterwards.
All right, sounds good. And here is the mail.
All right, so Dan in Minnesota. I've moved to Bemidji. Oh, this is Dan who was on the we featured as a sort of a news bit or also mail mm-hmm. that he was. His picture was featured in a bike safety ad. Right?
On a big outdoor stand-up advertisement.
Yeah. I've moved to Bemidji, Minnesota, and part of Active Living Bemidji, which is a blog.
I believe it's an organization encouraging health and fitness for people living in Bemidji. So.
Which is difficult. I've actually been to Bemidji.
Is that right?
A few times.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, I had friends up there.
Okay.
Winters suck.
Ah, easy enough.
Well, Minnesota winters are kind of unique in their way, but I certainly wouldn't want to go outside in winter. And I think like August is really the only month I would prefer to be outside.
It's
in
a place of extremes.
Yeah,
I'm curious if Dan, because I know Dan built his own tiny house at one point and lives in. So I'm wondering if he moved that to Bemidji or if he moved into a different situation
or building his own another.
A second tiny house. Yeah, yes, yeah. I don't know. And also, is the first one on Airbnb, and can I stay in it now?
Ethan donates and says, oh, no, we say thank.
We say thanks for the donation.
Thanks for the... I'm going back there. Ethan donates. Thank you, Ethan.
Yes.
And he also says, hey, guys, I've been enjoying your podcast for quite a while now. Thought I'd write to tell you that I really liked episode 137 with Ethan Jewett and the disaster relief trials.
We did too.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite ones to record. I wish I could participate in something like that. I also wanted to mention that I'm in the small group of listeners who got a kick out of the whole Dune conversation. Who needs a fat bike when you can ride a giant sandworm, right? That's right. And lastly, that would be Shai Hulud, by the
way. That's right.
And lastly, I'll second Ethan's recommendation of Wind Up Girl by Paolo Bassiagalupi.
Well done. I couldn't pronounce that.
There are bikes in it, and if nothing else, has forever changed the way I think about ice cubes.
And I just got that book from the library today.
Great. I'm intrigued now. I live in Albany, New York. And while we don't have cycle scene or community that you have in the People's Republic of Portland, I like that he refers to it.
That's right.
That way.
Yeah.
Listening to your podcast inspires me to do more here. And because I believe in putting my money where my mouth is, I'm sending you guys some beverage money.
Hey.
Many thanks and keep up the good work.
We're drinking your beverage money.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ethan. Appreciate it.
And by the way, this has not relaxed me at all.
Okay, so all that talk about not mixing with booze is bullshit.
Yeah. I'm not mellowed out.
Okay.
Marcus also donated. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you, Marcus. And I feel like Marcus is a return donor. I couldn't, I was trying to check my, I'm sure the record exists. I didn't look hard enough, but it looks like a familiar name. So Marcus, thank you again.
Yeah. And I just got to say, like, it's always humbling and encouraging too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whenever somebody donates.
Totally.
To us, it's great. Thank you guys very much. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about that, but just, kind of. Yeah, I don't know. I enjoy doing this, and this is great, and we would kind of probably continue doing this if we didn't have some donors or whatever, but it's nice that we do because it makes doing this a lot easier.
Right. Yeah, and cheaper.
Yeah, and it also says, like, hey, you know, other people are enjoying us do this.
Right. It's affirming on multiple levels.
Yeah.
So thank you, both of you, and all of you guys who have donated in the past.
Robert says, I really enjoyed listening about new people moving to Portland and going carless. This is in reference to the Blunts.
The Blunts, yeah.
We are a family of five planning to go carless in Portland in October. We are waiting until October because that is when we are moving there. We lived in Hillsboro 3 years ago and were transferred to Boise. We are trying to find a place in Lad's Edition. Tough market right now, though. This is our first time without a car, or this will be our first time without a car, and we bought two mid-tail bikes. You'll have to explain to me what those are.
I was curious. I was trying. Either it's like long tail, like with a seat, like a Surly Big Dummy or something like that, or it's like the trail along, like it's a bike, and then there's another bike that the kid sits on behind it. Either way, it sounds like they're going to be moving kids.
Okay. Yeah, well. Excellent. Yeah, we have three kids and are making a trial run here in Ocean Shores, Washington. Hope to see you guys in Portland. Yeah,
yes.
Come on over.
Let us know when you get here.
Yeah. P.S. Wanted to thank you for your handling of your email about the conservative lady that wrote in, as we are also very conservative and nervous about being quite different in Portland. We are accepting of people in general, as most people seem to be. We hope to agree to disagree on some issues and find areas we can agree on.
Well, I think we can all agree that nobody wants you to be a dick. That's probably like the
civility
in the conversation is the biggest thing.
You know, like I will say most of the, for lack of a better term, close-mindedness I've encountered, and I'll own this, you know, has been on the left.
Oh, yeah? Have you been a close-minded liberal?
But that's by definition like the Socialist Workers Party right there.
Oh, sure. Okay. You know, easy enough.
Which I used to be a member of. So.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Wait. Now I've just blacklisted myself.
That's getting dangerous now.
I'll never work in this town again.
Seriously. Well, hey, that's our mail. And for the first time in whoever knows how long, we have news.
Yeah.
We're going to do this. We're going to take a fair running start at actually doing news. So, are you ready for this?
Do it.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. It circles around the city lights.
And I'll have to apologize. I did not give you the news, Aaron, so I will be reading the news.
Okay, that's cool. I was looking for it and couldn't find it.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, yeah, go ahead.
Well, one of the things, the Portland Tribune, this is about a month ago. Oh, no, this is... May 16th, actually. So this is 2 months old by now. But we mentioned in an earlier program the idea that Walgreens was going to be offering drive-through pharmacy pickups.
Yes, I've been following this.
For bicyclists. And I'm pretty sure we haven't talked about this yet. If so, that'll be I'll take the hit. But
we can be redundant.
Yes, we can, and we are, and will be, and shall be, and are.
Well put.
We talked about the idea that Walgreens, first of all, in Portland, not too far from where I now live, got scolded by local bicyclists for not permitting or for their employees not permitting bicyclists to come through their drive-through pharmacy pickup.
Thus creating a nationwide revolution throughout the chain of Walgreens.
Yeah, so it's gone national. The thing is that Walgreens all over America now is saying, hey, we support active transportation, we like people being healthy, and we're going to say, you guys go ahead and do that in every city. So we'll see how the rollout goes, like the actual implementation of that policy.
Right.
We'll find out. And there are certain places where maybe that just wouldn't happen. Like maybe there are no bicyclists that want to get drugs from Walgreens, but that's a thing that's happening. So there's that. There's a story here on Bike Portland, written by Michael Anderson from he's a recent addition to the Bike Portland staff.
Not to be mistaken with Ian Michael Anderson.
That's true.
Formerly of MTV's The State.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Totally different person. There's a really interesting thing happening here across the river in Vancouver. A bike shop and local bike advocate sat down with the police over beers and came up with a smart, simple, free program to help recover stolen bikes.
Yeah.
So, Bad Monkey Bikes in Vancouver enters your bike serial number and contact info in their database and applies a special Monkey Shield sticker to show that it's done so, which I like Monkey Shield. And the sticker here on it's just a shield with a monkey's face on it. The Bad Monkey Bikes monkey who looks bad, admittedly. But when a police or CTRAN or any department recover a bicycle and has that Bad Monkey sticker, they know it's registered and they know to call the shop manager. So not only is it a way to help respond bike theft, which is going on strong, apparently, it's a nice example of a simple service a local shop can offer that web-based competitors cannot. So local business for the win.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Well, there was an issue. It's several years old now. There was an issue with a bike shop that's also no longer in service. And the issue was with them was, this was in the Willamette Week.
Oh, yeah. Was this the recyclery?
They were like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't the recyclery.
Okay. Because they were accused of selling stolen bikes, I remember.
Right. Because the recyclery is still around. It's one that's not around anymore.
Okay. Oh, is it still around? Their big shop.
I thought they were.
Down on Hawthorne is gone. But they might still have a shop. I can't remember.
I thought they were a North Portland shop.
Oh, okay.
I might be thinking of someone else.
Hmm.
But anyways, yeah, it was this shop actually on Division and 50th that would sell at least to, they didn't know they were, but, or claimed that they didn't know that they were stolen, but there was a lot of their inventory that turned up to be like stolen or reportedly stolen bicycles.
For shame.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
that's terrible.
And sometimes it is hard to tell. Like, I'm not necessarily going to give this shop the benefit of the doubt if the majority of their inventory was stolen, but it's kind of hard to tell. Like, sometimes you can't necessarily, you know, look up a serial number in any database. Sometimes you don't even want to take the time either.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, if you find a sweet deal, best not to know, at least for the consumer.
Well, yeah,
the second consumer. But yeah,
we have a common friend that got a really nice bike for cheap. He actually took the time to try to find any kind of report.
That's true.
On it.
And I feel
and didn't find any, but it's still like, as we were discussing it, him and us, it still seemed like it was kind of a too good of a deal for the type of bike that it was.
Yeah, the situation in which the bicycle was acquired leads me only to believe that it was stolen. But at the same time, like, I mean, once you've done all the footwork and you can't find the original owner, it hasn't been reported as stolen.
Right, and that's the thing. Like, it's possible for a shop, anyways, to have done all the footwork and still not found whether or not this maybe actually stolen bike has been stolen.
Yeah. I was listening to the Bikes and Beer show from Fort Collins, which I was on last summer. And I would say everybody check them out. They air, I think the program airs live on a web stream every Wednesday. It's, 6 o'clock mountain time. So anyways, they're great. They're on the internet. You can find them. But they were talking, there was a story that Zach, who is one of the hosts on Bikes and Beer, apparently found a really nice bike leaning up against a tree. And it had been there like all day outside of his shop. And so he said, well, we should roll this in and like protect it just in case someone, you know, like lost their bike or forgot their bike or something. And so he tried so hard to find the owner. When he actually found the owner, the guy was like, oh yeah, I lent it to my friend. He lost it. And
he lost it against a tree, apparently.
Exactly. And so yeah, they tried to set up like a meeting to get the bike back to its owner, and the guy never showed. And so, yeah, even weird. After finding the owner was just like, nah. So weird.
I don't know how someone could be so flippant about their bike.
Well, I know how.
That's so strange.
It's like your parents or somebody else buys it for you.
Oh,
and you're like,
yeah, maybe
well,
so.
That was fun. I guess I lost it.
I don't know. Like, my bike is like my horse, you know?
Well, now as an adult. But I remember my grandpa bought me a bike when I was in college, and I rode it through college. But then I just set it out on my back porch post-college, living in a house of dudes, an apartment of dudes. And, you know, it was there for like 3 months, and then somebody stole it. And I was like, well, that sucks. So.
I dig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next up, Los Angeles Times talking about Seattle. A public library on a bicycle? Seattle has one. Can you see this picture?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a pilot program being rolled out this year where they can carry up to 500 pounds of books. The program is called Books on Bikes. And I assume if this goes well, it's going to continue. But apparently, the books on bikes.
They should hook up with Laura Moulton.
Yeah. Well, this is very much like a former guest of Street Books. Yes. It's staffed by 11 librarians. The mobile collection will visit neighborhoods and public gatherings throughout the summer. The collection includes about 400 titles and includes fiction and children's and teen literature. Branch librarian Jared Mills told the Library Journal, we really try to have in that collection what is attention-grabbing, again, reflective of diversity through the city. We have a little bit of everything in that collection. So this is basically like a bookmobile, except you forget about the mobile, and then you're not burning gas.
Does it say like how they check out? Is it like kind of card catalog style?
They don't say that. I would assume. I mean, in a day of iPads and whatnot.
It's possible to like scan a library card, I guess.
Yeah, it does say each mobile library will come with a Wi-Fi connection and a tablet for the librarian to access the internet. So I would imagine that probably helps them out. Yeah. Next up, there is a great article, and I think I emailed this to you. There's a guy named Gabriel Amadeus who lives in Portland and recently took part in a thing from, Velo Dirt, which is kind of a group of people that do...
That's a great name.
Yeah, gravel grinding and backcountry types of rides. He gives a fascinating write-up of riding from Klamath Falls, Oregon, back up through the eastern part of the state, mostly on gravel and unpaved roads. And this is awesome. Just the pictures that are here are amazing. Apparently, one of the days that they did the ride was 80 miles through desert with no water access.
Oh.
Which is pretty badass and pretty hardcore.
And, so did they must have carried a lot of water on the
bike, would assume so, yeah. And they stopped at the Cowboy Dinner Tree, which, there's a 30-ounce steak there. That's a place that we almost went to after our Crater Lake trip with Adam's parents.
Right. And instead, we went to the lake.
Totally.
Crater Lake.
Yeah. Lake of the Woods.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyways, this is a great write-up, and we totally recommend that people check it out. So, well, hey, that brings us up to probably a good stopping point.
Sure.
We are grateful again for all the listeners, grateful for everyone who supports the program, and looking forward to many more. So. Yeah.
And even though Ramones fans are the best fans in the world, Sprocket fans, you're pretty close.
If you're a Ramones fan and a Sprocket fan,
there you go.
Perfect, yeah.
Double.
Almost forgot to close up the news.
In owning and riding a bicycle. You are now an operator of a wheeled vehicle.
Just lastly, in summary, I would say that national forests are amazing things. We, when Adele and I were out in the woods, we were out for about 10 days. Only one of which we slept in a bed or inside of a house. Most of the time we camped for free because of dispersed camping and how the Forest Service and its management really are very accommodating to people who just like to go out and tramp through the woods. I will say we ended up doing about 470 miles. I calculated it. We didn't know
GPS
thingy? No, Google Maps.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Manually mapped it out through.
Yeah, I just sat down and traced out the roads rode on. And
I tried to do that with the North Bonneville trip, and it could never work out for me.
Yeah,
but anyways,
some routes are squirrely. Yeah. Just to say, after we went to Indian Heaven, and that was already great. We only did about 20 miles a day on that one because it was nice. We were camping out, kind of taking it easy. It was a vacation as well as a camping trip, so didn't want to push ourselves too hard. But then after that, we looked at the map and said, hey, I wonder if we can get from the Columbia River to Mount Rainier using Forest Service roads. And so we did. And we made it through Trout Lake on arguably the hottest day of the year. It was over 100 degrees, I think. And the ride from Salmon or White Salmon to Trout Lake is mostly uphill and mostly very hot and unprotected and out in the direct sun. So,
unpaved or
no, that was paved. The way through Trout Lake. And we found some great campsites. Even the ones that are kind of established campsites are oftentimes free, not the campgrounds, but just like sites off the road where people build fires and skin their deer and stuff after hunting. A lot of good places, I should say.
It's all one place.
Yes, there is a lot of good place out there. But we made it up. The Forest Service Road 23, I think, goes from Trout Lake to Randall, Washington, and part of that is unpaved. Unpaved is fun. If you have tires that can afford it, it works well. So, but we made it all the way from there through Packwood up to Mount Rainier National Park, got to Paradise to see the thing and eat a big hot dog, and then down past Mount St. Helens. So we basically saw all three mountains, and Mount Adams, I guess, being the third that I didn't mention. But yeah, it's totally possible. So I recommend anyone who wants to do that, they could do the same thing we did, which is jumpstart your trip using out of Portland. You can take C-Tran up to Vancouver, and there is one bus a day. Actually, there's two buses, but one in the morning, one in the afternoon. We took the morning out to Carson, which gets you very close to the forest. So yeah, I totally recommend it. And I guess anybody who is connected to me on Facebook could find the photos.
Sweet.
Yeah. Well, hey, this is probably a good place to close out our show. So, hey, thank you all again. And I won't repeat what I just said, but, you know.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call or leave us a message or SMS us at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hurtbird for our headline sounder, which we actually use this time. Find them at hurtbirdmusic.com. And lastly,
I just realized, looking at this hub, Rise Up Red, that DB Cooper's on the can.
Oh, I thought that's who that was.
What was the character from Mystery Men?
Oh, shoot.
Dr. Heller.
That was played by Tom Waits.
Yeah.
Yes.
Say it with me. Heller.
Oh, sorry. I was supposed to.
No, I'm here for the ladies.
Oh. Yeah, that's right.
That was great.
I don't live here, man.
Yeah.